Hello Capricorn, and welcome to Somewhere in Between Video Department, your 2024 annual readings from Planet Waves. I'm Eric Francis, your astrologer, coming to you on a beautiful snowy day here in the Astrology Chalet in Rosendale, New York. I'm working out of my normal location to have a whole different vibe and feeling and to try something new. This is my fourth video in the series. I'm working at about 1 in the afternoon on the 16th, I think it's Tuesday, the 16th of January 2024, a few days away from Pluto leaving your sign and entering Aquarius, with the exception of one last encore, which will be in Northern Hemisphere Spring 2024. Southern Hemisphere Spring, Northern Hemisphere Autumn for a couple of months later in the year, when Pluto just grazes Capricorn and gives you an opportunity for any final leftover business associated with this transit that's gone on since 2008. For the astrology studio reading, which you may or may not have, I did a review of the past 30 years of transits associated with Capricorn. We're going to move that reading onto the Somewhere in Between page so you have access to it, because I consider it to be essential and fundamental to be able to have a record of your transits and an understanding of just what it is you've been through. And I'll do some recapping here about that. But suffice it to say that Pluto transits are potent and they leave a lasting mark. Pluto has a 248-year orbit. It does not go through many signs in the lifetime of one person, though in our particular lifetimes, Pluto has been moving fairly quickly because Pluto has been at what's called perihelion, the closest point to the sun. That was, I guess, sometime maybe in the 80s. So Pluto's on the near side of its orbit, but now it's moving back out further away. It's got a very eccentric elliptical orbit. I don't know how much astronomy people know these days. People seem to be having difficulty with geography. But basically, just to put it simply, the pink dot is the sun, and Pluto is the blue ellipse. And fairly recently, Pluto was at the nearest point, and now Pluto is kind of moving out to one quarter of the way from its nearest point, which means that it's spending, if you can see that, spending more time in each sign because it's moving further from the sun. Hence, it covers fewer degrees per year. This has a number of different effects and on growth and development, but what it really means is that we're going to have 20 years of Pluto in Aquarius, and we've lived through about 16 years of Pluto in Capricorn, and that began in 2008, and the world responded immediately with a series of banking collapses and economic collapses and AIG, a massive insurance company that insures everything under the sun, had to be bailed out lest the entire economy fail. We really don't know if this is really all true, that individual corporations control the entire economy, but since the day that Pluto entered Capricorn, we've heard about little other than banking and war, and the structures that hold up society have basically been imploded. They've been collapsed on their own footprint. For you, the effect is what I called in the written reading a fundamental reconstruction of self, a complete rebuilding and restructuring of who you are, a dismantling of your psychic structure from the inside out. This did not necessarily feel like a dismantling of your psychic structure. It just may have felt like a lot of very, very intense nonstop changes. Though it was a Capricorn who described the process that he was going through as this kind of, you know, just taking apart and putting back together who you are. And it is likely to come as a relief that Pluto has left your sign. It will take some pressure off. The one thing that an astrologer that I hold dear to my heart, Martha Lang Westcott, Treehouse Mountain, the author of a series called Tools of the Trade, and one of the early and still very few genuine asteroid masters, said in one class that Pluto transits are really intense, but we tend to miss them when they're gone. And we miss them when they're gone because they provided this dependable source of, in a sense, pressure. They provided a dependable source of impetus, not necessarily of inspiration, but of drive to keep going through the changes that you were going through. And the changes that you were going through matched the world, which was going through these massive upheavals. And there's not a lot of people who recognize that the changes that they're going through have anything at all in common with the changes that the world is going through. But sometimes we see it, you know, like you may be going through something really profound in your life, and maybe flip on the TV and the news just seems really unbelievable, and you think, well, I wonder how I would be perceiving this if I weren't going through this these changes that I'm going through now. But they are directly related, and the world will change as a result of Pluto leaving Capricorn and entering Aquarius. One has led the way to the next. And you are emerging from this, I think, as a fundamentally different person than you were in 2008. Though we might ask whether the process of Pluto was like sculpting a sculpture out of marble and gradually revealing the thing that was contained within it. I have other sculptors other than Michelangelo, I'm sure, have said this, but Michelangelo once said, well, he knows the finished result is in there, and he just has to remove everything that's in the way. And if you've seen some of his sculptures, you think, well, bet he worked for him, and he got results, and Pluto does get results. And so you've been through one of the most challenging transits that a person can go through. And if you check out the Astrology Studio video, which is, that's in the during the year version of the Year Ahead Astrology. But I did this unusual thing where I looked back for the first half. I'm probably going to do the same thing with Aquarius. There have been just there's been so much constant change over the past 30 years, it's difficult to even summarize it with, for example, peak years. 1993, if you're old enough, very, very important year. So, meantime, I think that continuing a very brief look back, and I'm not setting a time limit on these readings, they seem to be going about the length of my in-person consults, a bit over an hour. The peak year of, there were two major peaks of Pluto and Capricorn. One was, I would say, 2011 through 14, the 2012 era. 2011 was huge, a year of planetary changes and social upheaval. And then when Saturn caught up with Pluto in January 2020, there was yet another kind of expression of complete planetary upheaval that resulted in the global lockdown and this energy of contraction, and people just so convinced that fear was the only way to go. Nothing else worth paying attention to than abject terror over what we should be asking today, 4 years later, in 2024, as the controllers attempt to play new games with us. So, the essence of the transition from for you, from Pluto, from Capricorn into Aquarius, is one of the expression of what you have learned. So the way that it looks, very simply, on what's called the solar chart, and let's pause for a second and talk about the solar chart. The solar chart, and when I reach and do this, I'm turning my monitor back on. This thing has a power-saving device that's not very helpful. I'm connected to wall current by, anyway. the solar chart is the chart for the sign and not the person. I know astrology makes a tremendous fuss over having the birth time right. I try to get the birth time right when I'm doing a chart. Cindy and I can work for days to try to find out what time exactly something happened. Things with unreliable times, events, global events with unreliable times, it's usually something wrong. But this is a different branch of astrology. This is solar astrology, the use of the solar chart, which means that the position of the sun is presumed to be the ascendant or the first place. It also works very well with the rising sign. So it is a simplified version on one level, and then I bring in a lot of detail in terms of planets and a lot of experience reading these charts. I can't believe that I've been doing this 29 years, but I have been. And so I've learned a lot, and I've studied, you know, the work of the masters, and you know, that includes Patrick Walker, Linda Goodman, Jonathan Kaner, Sally Brompton. The best horoscope writers really teach you that the solar house system is not only real and workable, but a genuinely beautiful thing. So, again, we're talking about sun sign and rising sign, and some people swear by these readings for their moon sign. They're just those lunar people. You may be one of them. Okay, so in this system, the reference sign is Capricorn. That's why this is called the Capricorn reading. And that occupies the entire first place in the chart. And so what Pluto is doing is it is moving from the first place to the second place or house in the chart. I use the word place most of the time. There's no word house in ancient Greek. As far as I know, it's actually place. And here's the 12th place. This is where Pluto was from around 1994 till around 2008, 2009. So Pluto crossed your solar ascendant or the first degree of Capricorn. I tend to use whole sign houses. Not religiously, but I think they're pretty amazing. And in 08, 09. So now this is finding its counterpart in 23, 24 as Pluto moves into Aquarius, and that's your second place. And any house, it's going to be an extension of the affairs of the previous house. So the first house brings out something that was latent, lingering in the behind the scenes of your chart in the 12th house, and the second house brings out the expression of what the first house is about. And there's plenty going on here still. We're going to come back to that. But and so Pluto moving from Capricorn to Aquarius is calling on you to focus your values, which are the principles by which you make decisions, based on what you've learned during the Pluto in Capricorn era. So if you've been meekly paying attention, Pluto has tried to get your attention over and over again, And there have been life lessons. There have been things that you have just learned about and figured out and were determined to understand about yourself. A lot of what happened could qualify as what you might think of as enforced growth. That is to say that you were put under a certain degree of pressure to grow. That's good. I'm so insecure about video and lavalier microphones. Please forgive me. Video is not my element. I am merely faking it right now. And I'm sitting in front of this incredibly complicated thing. Ah, when I just, just give me a good old-fashioned magnet in my face, a microphone. But we're here, and you like this, and I'm getting there. I'm starting to like it. So, you've been confronted with enforced changes and life lessons, and have come out on the other end. And so now the question is, how has this adjusted your principles? How have you grown in your capacity to honor your own constitution, basically? You can think of Pluto in Capricorn as a kind of constant revision of your personal constitution. Now the question is, are you going to follow your constitution? And the place where you follow your constitution is in Aquarius. Now, there's interesting parallels between the two signs. First of all, they're both ruled by Saturn. Capricorn is the nighttime expression of Saturn, called the nocturnal side of Saturn. Aquarius is the diurnal side of Saturn, and it's an easy metaphor to see. Capricorn is earthy and more introverted, a little more taciturn, perhaps a little less idealistic, more grounded, more practical. Aquarius has a more idealistic expression, and it is potentially a little bit more visionary, and it brings other people in. It can't abide the kind of isolation that Capricorn, not that you like it, but you can certainly abide the kind of isolation better than Aquarius can. And so now comes the question, what do you do with all that you've learned? And there's a necessary expansion of your purview, of your domain, of the ways and places you express yourself with Pluto in Aquarius. You have a broader field of experience, and we go really from Capricorn is kind of the sign of executive leadership. Be one person at the top. Aquarius, we start to get into groups and committees and organizations, and it doesn't make it easier. It's been said many times, and I think that it's true, that a committee of one gets things done because all of the ways in which people can interfere with progress and vote things down and their insecurities get in the way. Doesn't happen when there's a committee of one. But now there's less likely to be a committee of one in your life and more likely to be, a family consultation process, a group consultation process on some level, and also your role in leadership of groups and your role of bringing the principles to groups. And there are going to be many, many lessons of Pluto and Aquarius for society. And those include matters of individuality that are perhaps slightly easier to handle when you don't subject yourself to the pressure of other people But we have just been through a phase of history where there has been so much pressure put on people to conform that it has been not only outrageous that this happens, but that people are willing to play along with this. They're willing to fall for this. They're willing to give up any semblance of their own individuality or autonomy. And we might question whether most people even had any to begin with. But with Pluto having been through your sign, there is absolutely no question that you have a sense of who you are better than most people. You are a recent Pluto and Capricorn graduate. And one of the things you have learned is to be yourself. All of that chiseling away of extraneous marble around the magnificent sculpture has meant that who you are has been brought out, has been revealed to first to yourself and then to other people, mostly to yourself. And now, as the context changes into a group context, to the people who are around you. And it is likely that you're going to be a focal point of the gathering of groups, that you will be someone who takes a moral and ethical leadership of groups, that is really the same as spiritual leadership of groups, and that the things that you have learned will become the things that others can benefit from. And that's a lot of responsibility, but it would seem to me that you are going to be the upholder of group values. Now, the interesting thing about Capricorn, almost all that I'm talking about is about the solar chart configuration. You don't need natal charts to work on this archetypal and philosophical level of astrology, but try this on. There were probably times in your life where you were much more susceptible to some kind of need to feel as if you needed to have a consensus to be able to make a decision. The thoughts that you thought in your mind and the choices you were making, you may have considered as being subject to evaluation by others. This meant that at previous times in your life, others were able to pressure you more. Others were able to kind of outvote you on matters that didn't really involve them. See, that's the strange thing, right? We're talking about your second house, your principles, your values, your underlying purposes, causes, necessities, principles. I think the second house is very succinctly defined as principles. It's also things like available cash, your talents, the tools of your trade, self-esteem, very important. And Capricorn can struggle with self-esteem because of the Saturn rulership, of the need to have this idea that you must in some way always be acceptable to authority. And under Pluto conditions, and recently Saturn conditions, because Saturn reached its peak of it was basically 2018 to 2020, if I recall correctly, maybe a bit of 2017, and then the Saturn-Pluto conjunction happens on 1/12/20, and then Saturn quickly moves on to Aquarius. So you've had Saturn in your life as well, which has been formative in slightly different ways. But Saturn, I think, as does Pluto, we respond well to Saturn transits when we internalize the authority principle rather than having to have the authority principle imposed on us. So any astrologer working with a client on a Saturn transit pretty much is duty bound to say, look, the Saturn principle is the reality principle and the authority principle, but the essence of that is that you take it on. You no longer need the government or your wife or your husband or whatever to boss you around, including your boss. You need to hold true to the authority principle within yourself, and that really means making your own decisions. And that theme has come up over and over again the past 6 years, and it is not easy for people who have no concept of internal authority and then tend to first express internal authority by rebelling against external authority. That's not, you know, maybe that works for like a week, but that's about it. And I think if we humans need anything, it is to be responsive to our internal authority principle. And that means the reality principle, honoring the reality principle. So what I'm getting at here is that having Aquarius on your second house has potentially indicated a lack of autonomy around your own principles, choices, and decisions, but that has been addressed now by one transit after the next that has compelled you to hold your own against others. And now with Pluto entering Aquarius, that is being magnified. Not only to hold your own against others, but to actively stand up to group pressures, to take leadership within group situations, and then to accept the responsibility that entails. So, this journey lasts a long time. I would say that 20 years counts for the foreseeable future. There will be many instances where I can point back in time, such as, for example, Pluto, Saturn, and Aquarius, from around March of 2020 till around March of 2023, where you will have a kind of a preview. So if you look at how you handled yourself during this very distinct phase of history, right? When Saturn gets into Aquarius in the spring of 2020, the world is being ordered to lock down. How did you respond? What did you do? Who did you choose to believe? Why did you choose to believe it? And how do you feel about the decisions that you made for yourself and any others that you may be responsible for in the subsequent 2 to 3 years? All of 20, all of 21, and into 22 were the critical years. We all had to make decisions during that time. We all were confronted with the need to stand up to something much bigger than ourselves. What did you do? How did you handle it? Because the answers to those questions are going to guide you and influence you on what you're going to do in the context of what are almost certain to be another much slower played out round of movements where what claims to be the collective imposes itself on the individual. Do you simply comply? Do you stand up and resist? Or do you take leadership and inspire some form of group initiation? Which is it? What do you do? All right, let's move on. One of the defining principles of Capricorn is that you have Pisces in the third place. Let's put the monitor back on. It dims out to save power. There's so much infinite electricity. One of the defining principles of Capricorn is that you have Pisces in the third place. Any description of the sign Capricorn should take that into account. And this is really an interesting feature of Capricorn, because you know you're an Earth sign ruled by Saturn, and then your second house, your values and your principles are an air sign ruled by Saturn. Then we get to the third house, which is your mental expression. That's here. That's ruled by Pisces. So the third house, its contents, its transits, its the very idea for you, being involved with Pisces means that you want to think intuitively, that your mind is an intuitive thing, that you don't necessarily depend upon or want to depend upon cognitive, rational, brick and mortar thinking. That at times you just know things. However, with Neptune transiting Pisces during these years, the issue has been that you might think that you know things, but you don't really know things. You might think that you understand something and that you have it right, and you don't need to think it through. But then it turns out that that wasn't so accurate after all. What the heck was I thinking? Well, the chances are that you weren't thinking. The chances are that you were under some kind of delusional or deceptive influence of Neptune. And this has been hard for everyone. I heard somewhere, I never saw this presentation, that my old friend Barbara Hand Clow gave a talk on how Neptune in Pisces was the elephant in the room. Now, I know Barbara, and I think she's a very good astrologer, and I knew exactly what she meant. I'm sure there's, if you know where to find this lecture, please send it to me, but I didn't need any more than the title. But, she's at it again. She knows what's going on. She can see the invisible, and the invisible is the problem with Neptune in Pisces. It is an invisible influence. It is an invisible influence that is below the liminal level, and because you have Pisces there, it's even going to be more subliminal. And yet, in some ways, many ways, it served as your guidance system, particularly during the years of Pluto in Capricorn. But now your ruling planet has entered Pisces. This took place March of 2023. Saturn entered Pisces. And this, I trust, came as a tremendous relief, as if somehow the fog had finally cleared, or someone finally dug you out of your half-mile driveway and you can get into town and buy some milk and eggs. Saturn is a reality principle. Neptune is the fantasy principle. And the way to answer fantasy is with reality, and I'm all for flights of fancy and flights of the imagination and the liberation of the spirit through art, music, and the imagination. But by the elephant in the room, she meant this is the overwhelming influence that is drowning out intelligence, consciousness, and even imagination. And if we want to understand something about the problems of the world that we see, perhaps consider this kind of narcotic effect of Neptune in Pisces. Oh, well, now we have Saturn in Pisces. The Narcan has arrived. And the Narcan is saying, okay, time to wake up and pay attention. Time to get into facts and figures. Nothing like facts and figures when Neptune is around. And so there's been a significant change in your overall mental framework since Saturn entered Pisces, a change in your personal outlook, a shift in the way that you conceive of and understand things, the way that you think things through, and possibly a reversal of all the thought tendencies that you've had for the past, more than 10 years. Now, there was a fairly brief, not long enough interval of Chiron in Pisces, and that may have provided for you a kind of window out of the fog. The Chiron in Pisces era was, if we go back to 2018, we're really looking at about 2011 to 2019. So Chiron hasn't been there for a while. Well, Chiron has moved on. We're going to get to Chiron and Aries in the next part of this. This is very important. Reality is dawning on you in new ways just in time. Saturn's presence and placement has a way of being a timing factor. Now, there is another element in Pisces that is not very well documented in contemporary astrology, though there are articles written about it, but I'm not so sure about them. That is Nessus. Nessus is the third centaur planet. They came in the following order: Chiron in 1977, the first planet named for a centaur, amazingly, that hadn't been dialed in before. It's incredible, but it was, I think the name was put on it around 1980 by Charlie Kowal, the discoverer. And then in 1992, Pholus manifested. We're going to probably end on Pholus, because Pholus is now in Capricorn. And that takes the healing principles of Chiron and expresses them in a new way, because Chiron is more Saturn-like. It has a more containing property than Pholus does. Pholus has the property of the spontaneous release, of the release of pressure, the off-gassing, the opening of the bottle, letting the genie out, which can't be. It only goes back in if it decides to. You can open it, but you can't put it back in. Then came Nessus the next year. And Nessus is very deeply concerned with the consequences of things. The story of the cycle of the myth is basically boomerang-shaped. In every facet of the Nessus myth comes back to the point of origin of the protagonist. And there are two main sides to Neptune. Working at its best, the concept of Nessus, is the buck stops here. The concept on the kind of murky side is victimhood. And so all of this victim chic that we are seeing really starts to accelerate and gain wild popularity upon Nessus entering Pisces, and it takes us through the conversion of feminism to victimization and numerous other forms of what I call victim chic. It is fashionable to be a victim. It is one of the few forms of social cachet that responds. I keep going through the list. The list is money earned very quickly for nothing. That's special. People love that. Raw power, okay, that's special. People love that. And victimization, that's a big one. Fame for absolutely nothing, that's almost like a twist on being a victim, because then a lot of people who are famous for absolutely nothing are like victims of their fame. But the victim chic thing is boring. I'm sure that you do not like it. And it is now going to be meeting its counterpart in Saturn. And so one of the most dramatic events of the year that is, if you see this written about or talked about somewhere else, I am very interested in hearing what other astrologers have to say about the forthcoming conjunction of Saturn and Nessus that basically spans from July 24 through February 25. What is that about? Well, this is going to put a big chill on victim chic. And I don't think you've needed Saturn to do this. Maybe Saturn will help you in a way that you didn't know that you needed guidance. But it is a major wake-up call, both individual and collective, on the whole matter of taking responsibility for, here in Pisces in the third house, your ideas, your words, and what happens in your local community. So the emphasis of Saturn in the third house, and I mean, this is an easy read from classical astrology. The emphasis of Saturn in the third is stay local. Keep your interests near you. We would all learn a lot from this. I think we all need to learn more about keeping our interests near us. And in a way, rediscovering and developing the environment around us as the most important antidote to the onslaught of digital conditions. We are in right now a major toxic episode, which is associated with digital conditions, associated with overexposure to this disembodying, fragmenting technology that we are obsessed with. We have committed our lives to it. And not in creative ways, right? We have no choice but to either be in the environment or have it be near us in some way. But more or less creative is the question. So with Saturn in the third, the nature of the discussion is, okay, am I taking responsibility for the creative thoughts in my mind, for the ideas I have, for how I express myself, for the words that I choose? And the third house, I think, would also represent the decisions that you make, because the third is very cognitive. The third is where we think things through, and it's the style in which we think things through. And if at any point in the past, let's go back to just for shits and giggles, 2012, past 10 years, you have not wanted to take responsibility for a decision that you've made. The question is, did you really make the decision? Did you opt out of making the decision? If we get to Sedna, which I'm going to work through the houses pretty much in order. So we'll get to Sedna. Sedna is changing signs also, and Sedna is the story of what happens when you don't make the decisions that you need to make. We'll get there. So, third house action. What's going to happen is that Saturn moves a lot quicker than Neptune. And this is the end of the cycle. This is like the last phase crescent moon, so close you can't even see it. So Saturn is closing in on Neptune. But the conjunction takes place in Aries. Aries is the scene of a lot of excitement from now on. So one benefit you have from this is that for as long as Neptune is in Pisces, Saturn will also be in Pisces to help set some boundaries. Right? This is, boundaries are very important for Pisces and very important for Neptune because they can represent the complete dissolution of boundaries. And sometimes the feeling is, my insanity must be your truth. Completely ridiculous. So Saturn is saying that we must have some objective, excuse me, mostly really loud with the lav mic on, some objective concept of what is true and what is not. And you'll have that tool. And what, you know, Nessus has been around for a while. It's not news. But what is new is Saturn coming in to put the pressure on Nessus, to call the question, to insist on the Saturnian side of Nessus coming out. Nessus is a Saturn crosser, and I think it goes all the way out to Pluto's orbit. It's one of the most interesting points there is because of this, and it encompasses so much of what we live with. Before I move on to the fourth house, it's one important element of Nessus that I think is wholly integral to this matter of victim chic and not taking responsibility for one's decisions, which is a gray area around the matter of sexual consent. Now, if you've heard any of my last 20 talks on sexual consent, I'm saying sexual consent is a ridiculous concept, that we must be operating on the basis of love and desire, of trust and decisions and choices. And so to turn the sexual encounter into a legalistic contract, yes, I sign, I give consent, I sign on the dotted line, the notary stamps it, is ridiculous. But desire, no. Appropriateness, that makes sense. Desire makes sense, appropriateness makes sense. Appropriate, is this thing we're planning to do appropriate in this moment that we're doing it? That's a good question. In the story of Nessus, in this myth that involves the crossing of a river with Nessus as the ferryman, there is a sexual encounter between someone named Deianira and this bad boy centaur named Nessus. And all the centaurs except for Chiron and Pholus are basically bad boys of some kind. All the ones besides that, they're like the Hell's Angels of astrology. But Pholus and Chiron, who seem to be very related, not the same necessarily lineage, genetically and mythologically, but they are the spiritual types. They are the teacher types. Pholus is the keeper of a temple. Chiron is also the keeper of a temple, but it's a healing temple. He teaches medicine to humanity. Chiron teaches medicine to humanity. Nessus' job is to guard a river. He charges tolls for the crossing. Heracles, the big hero, escaping from a war. God knows what Deianira, his wife, was doing there, but he pawns her off on Nessus. Heracles could easily get her across the river. It confounds me, and I think this is a part of the Nessus question. Why did Heracles? Heracles can, rip forests out of the ground with his bare hands. Why did he give his wife to this centaur with this terrible reputation? They have sex. what kind of sex? It's ambiguous. According to Melanie, Dieter Cook, Robert von Heeren, the people who have done the in-depth research on the myths, who I know and respect, it's a question. Was it consensual? Was it a toll? Or was it rape? Oh, doesn't that sound like a question of our time? The question of our time, where sexuality is concerned. And I think that the most important element of the Nessa story is that hazy area. And what I think that the Saturn-Nessus conjunction is saying is that that hazy area, which happens to relate to a sexual encounter in the myth of Nessus, has application in many other facets of life. Was it freely given? Was it a toll paid? Or was it taken? Whatever that might relate to. And to know the basis of the decision and to not pretend something was what it wasn't. Something cannot be freely given on Saturday and be taken on Sunday. The decision made on Saturday is the decision that must stand. And here we have the very essence of what Nessus is about. And as Melanie very efficiently casts this, the essence of this myth, the buck stops with you. Okay, let's look at the fourth. Now this, I'm not... I'm having to wrangle this idea of Aries on the fourth house quite a bit in my mind as I read these powerful events in Aries for Capricorn, and I always get a little all through this process, and you know, even writing the horoscope, I hesitate on a distinct interpretation of Aries on the fourth, and then these big events in Aries on the fourth. But let's give it a try, and let me just show you the structure. So you can see in this chart that there are four dark lines, and the four dark lines represent, how do I get me and the chart and the, here we are. The four dark lines represent the horizon and the meridian. Now, because we're using solar astrology, these are conceptual. These are not the actual horizon and the meridian. They are the idea version, but they're also ideas in your natal chart. And the first house represents sense of self. The seventh house represents the wider environment and one's relationships, including business partners, marriage partners, and open enemies. And the fourth house represents matters of lineage, family, security, and one's home base. That's what we're going to look at in a second. The 10th house represents the action you take in the world, your business reputation, your relationship to power and authority, and it also has a lot to do with family. So houses 10 and 4 have a lot to do with family. You could say that the seventh does, because the seventh is about partnerships, and families generally start with partnerships of some kind, better or worse, partnerships that do or don't end up in family court, but nonetheless, it starts with some kind of a partnership. So there is, completely understating the case, a lot of activity going on in Aries. Chiron is there. The strange and distant planet Eris is there, and there's going to be a total eclipse of the sun conjunct Chiron. Now, to have Aries in the fourth place says a lot about Capricorn, because the fourth place is about the structure of the home, the tradition of the family, the lineage, and in many ways it's the patriarchal lineage, it's the father's line, the father's estate. That's the fourth house. It's the ancient house of fathers. The mothers show up in the 10th generally, though Barbara gives interesting commentary about this in the Chiron book, And it's and Dave Arner, one of my teachers too, I've had some great teachers, said, well, you want to find out a little bit about who the dominant parent was in the child's, it's usually a dominant parent. And you want to find out about who that person was and find out about what made them who they are and how you responded to your dominant parent. But for the most, and then you can start to see fourth, tenth attribution. But if we take the fourth as the house of one's security base, the sense of safety in the world, this is important place that you orient. One of my theories of astrology generally and solar astrology in particular is that where you have Aries, you will seek your self-actualization. So having a home is very important to Capricorn because it's where your physical home is your home for growth. Your physical home is your mental home. Your physical home is your emotional home. And so that's really important when you have Aries on the fourth house cusp, occupying the entire fourth house. It means you're going, that you need your place to find yourself. And it also says that you strive to be very self-reliant in your concept of security. You want to you want to be the source of your own security and not have to rely on other people. And there's the, you know, the great hardy frontier tradition of doing that. Now, ultimately, we all must interact with others in some way. We count on other people. And maybe in your case, we build the communities of our own design in order to have companionship and some way to spread the responsibility out and have a little more stability. So now, though there's been interesting activity in Aries for a while, I mean, Uranus passed through the territory in the 7 years before 2018, and Chiron's been there since 2018, 2019. To me, now this all comes to a big head. It comes to a big head because there's a big eclipse in Aries, your fourth house of your personal security and self-actualization, conjunct Chiron. This is big news. It is an eclipse that is unusual in many, many ways. And I keep coming to the conclusion that this is impossible, but I'm looking at it. And then potentially many of us who live in the northeastern U.S. will actually, or visit here, will get to see it on April 8th, 2024. So here's how this works, here's how it looks. And this chart is in the Aries reading. And it's a little difficult to see what's going on here, but let me just go in as close as I can and show you the combination of factors here, all of which have a 19 next to them. Chiron right there, then the sun, then the moon, right? It's Chiron, sun, moon. Look at that. And then the little horseshoe there, that's the lunar node. And anytime you see the sun near one of those little horseshoes, there's also the upside down horseshoe, that's in Libra, you know there's an eclipse of the sun or the moon on the way, because that's when the eclipses, when the sun gets near the lunar nodes, the eclipses are coming, or they're there. You're between them or they're on their way, they just happened. Proximity. The idea that we could get, and they aligned in the Aries eclipse conjunct Chiron, they aligned to the arc minute. If you cast the chart for Mexico, it's off by 2 arc minutes or 1/30th of 1 degree. This is still hilariously close. If we cast the chart for the new moon, which I did, where there is totality, which is in Burlington, Vermont, among other places. That's just where I picked because I like that town and I might be there for the event. They are aligned to the arc minute. So we've got the sun cycle, the moon cycle, the solar lunar cycle, the eclipse cycle, and the Chiron cycle all going off at the same time. I mean, it's like getting five cherries on a slot machine. That's a lot of Chiron. This is, we are now in the moment of the full expression of Chiron in Aries. Not a second too soon, because with Pluto in Aquarius, the gig is up on doing what you're told, plain and simple, or you're going to get crushed. So we need the self-actualization property of Pluto, of Pluto in Aquarius, but that is going to be fed by the Chiron eclipse in Aries. It's going to provide a kind of a handle so you can grab onto for the self-actualization process that will make it more accessible, make it more possible. And I would say that putting this together with having Aries on the fourth house, that honoring your self-actualization process, which is very much an interior, at-home thing, right? It's not the kind of thing you're going to do on Twitter. A lot of people think they're going to self-actualize on Twitter. If it's ever happened, I'd like to, you know, it should go in the Museum of the Internet. This is a real moment of waking up to yourself within yourself. It is a moment of self-understanding where you align who you are with your need for security, with your need for grounding, with your need for self-understanding, with some major discovery about who you are and what you want and why you are that way and why you are where you are. And the why you are where you are question is a very important question whenever the fourth house is in effect. Now, the reason that Aries is so important, and of all the readings so far, I've made this one the least involved in the media theory of what the internet has done to fuck up society and take people out of themselves. But that's really the theme of the astrology of Aries and Aquarius. Is these are the two major crime scenes of the disembodiment and tribalization of the human race right now. Electrical technology generally tribalizes people. And this has been going on for a long time. And the most tribalizing medium of them all has been radio. When the dawn of the radio era, Eris entered Aries. Ah, this is interesting. I think that the first radio license, I wish I kept better files, but this is fairly easy to recreate. The first radio license was issued with Eris and Pisces. But the radio era really begins with Eris in Aries. Grandpa McLuhan, his chapter in Understanding Media about radio is Beating the Tribal Drum. This is what tribalized humanity. The breaches of privacy, very important principle too. The breaches of privacy come in instantaneously upon the telephone being installed in rural communities like this, even in cities, where five homes would share one phone number and would have slightly different rings, and they were called party lines. And the telephone operators would eavesdrop on people's calls and were famously yentas. And so once the telephone was imposed, it was not this concept of my phone call is private. Your phone call was basically broadcasting to the neighborhood. We saw the breach of individuality and privacy and represented by electrical media. And then radio comes along and people rapidly tribalize. And that de-individuates. And then digital, well, television's another story, but let's skip TV for a second. I mean, we're in it. I mean, I'm talking to you on a television device, right? under the influence of TV, we all became characters. That was the influence of TV. Under digital influence, there is a highly polarizing effect because of the zeros and ones involved. And this is, I see this, you know, I see somebody mention this once a year, maybe, if ever, maybe they're getting it from me. And this is driving people insane. Digital thinking is algorithmic. It is conditioning people to think in routines, no more creatively than a pinball game. And you are in this moment where you are seeking your wholeness from all of this. All of this chaos and fragmentation, and there is information coming, and I'll show you what it looks like astrologically, if it matters at all. I propose that it does. At the moment of the eclipse, let's go in all the way here. See right above my finger, right there? There's that little green guy and the little red one. The green guy is Mercury. The red one is Eris. Eris, remember the dawn of radio, Eris in Aries. Look how close those are. And Mercury is applying retrograde to Eris. Retrograde planets are introspective, and they crave historical context. They want to dive into the past, and they want to retrieve something that's been lost. So retrograde is kind of a soul retrieval process. Where you have retrograde planets in your chart, it's probable that you have some form of a gift or a talent that you concealed because it threatened your early caregivers. It's a very important attribute of retrogrades. Wonder, what does that mean? What does it mean that I have it retrograde? Well, look at what the planet would say if it wasn't retrograde. Then imagine that being turned off because it threatened your mother or your babysitter or your father or your grandfather. And it's like, oh, I better not be too creative. But then they act as inner guides to help you find that thing and bring that thing out and into full expression. This is what you've got going on. There is a retrieval process connected with this eclipse. There's something from your early childhood that you are going to, and possibly much before your early childhood, that you're going to be able to bring up, to retrieve, and work with, and have. Okay, a couple of more things. I think that one of the greatest gifts of 2024 astrology for you, on every possible level, is the conjunction of Jupiter and Uranus in Taurus. There it is. That takes place only 12 days after the eclipse of April 8th. April 20th, they form their conjunction. One and only, then Jupiter moves on, forms a conjunction to Sedna in Gemini. This is the whole Sedna. The Sedna topic is another vast, vast topic that I will do another reading on that in the spring reading. But let's stick with the fifth right now. The fifth is the house of artistic expression. Now, by artistic expression, I don't mean paint by numbers. I don't mean most of what passes for art. When I say artistic expression, I mean that which involves you being a probe into the unknown and you taking a risk. Everything else is basket weaving. Artists, true artists who are probes, who are these sensitive antennas. And when you think of I say the word probe a lot, but think of the antennas on an insect. So let me some antennas here. Well, what do antennas do? They're probing into the environment. They're like feeling the wind. They're feeling the vibrations. Kitty cat's whiskers, very special things. This is why you should give your cat a big bowl, so it's not brushing its whiskers on the side of its bowl and getting what's called whisper fatigue. Cat's whiskers are incredibly sensitive. They're connected to nerve endings in the follicles that provide it with all kinds of information that you don't have. This is why you want to keep a cat around. But you are the probe when you are the artist, and when you are willing to do something that feels dangerous. So, Jupiter conjunct Uranus is a major expression of that probe quality and that willingness to take a risk and to try something new. And one of the ways that artists work as probes is they create something and insert it into the culture and they watch what happens. Whenever you see me doing these spoofs or satires, part of what I'm doing is I'm inserting something into the culture and I'm watching the reaction largely just for fun. And the fifth house is the house of fun. So one thing an artist can do is make something that's evocative and deep and risky and personally expressive, and then, for fun, see how the culture responds. And a lot of the greatest artists live this way. The artists we remember, the artists who feel the most fresh. And hopefully you have your list of favorites, and you know, maybe indulge them more and light your creative fire. So this is a tremendous gift. Jupiter then moves on to Gemini along with Sedna. And here Sedna is in itself an environmental probe, a very important environmental probe. And it is entering the mental environment as is Pluto entering the mental environment of Aquarius. They're essentially, as I go on with these readings, now let's see, 12 plus 4, I'm up to the 16th somewhere in between reading. Woohoo, 8 to go. Realizing these really are part of the same thing. To have these two potent, slow movers entering air signs the same year, big deal. Environmental probe into the mental environment, particularly Sedna. And this is where your work comes in. The fifth provides these probes, these daring experiments, but the sixth is your everyday work. Now, they may be related. The fifth and the sixth are very similar, but not for everyone. What are you here to do? You may have a major reevaluation and rethinking of what you're here to do every day, learning what you've learned from the risks you've taken, from the probes that you've placed in society, from the fun that you've had from observing this. What's your daily work? And how is that related to your wellness? Now, one thing about your daily work is it should either have two completely different careers that talk to each other or two very different facets of the same thing. I mean, I'm partly an example of that. I do astrology a lot of the time, and then a lot of the other time I'm involved in this extremely hardcore, somewhat dangerous investigative reporting that can involve tracking stories for years, and I've got a storage area with somewhere around 150,000 pages of documents from the history of chemicals, but I come to you as an astrologer. That's what it's like to have Gemini on the 6th. There's two separate things. Betty Dodson had Gemini on the 10th. So she was an artist and also an author and teacher. And she got the two working together. That was essentially the story of Betty in her 40s, was getting the artist working with the teacher. And so when you have Gemini in a workhouse, your work must have those facets. Okay, one last point, and I'm still working on this one, and that is this quad conjunction in Capricorn that is basically, over the past few years, come into place and replaced Pluto in Capricorn with something that is very old and very mysterious. So and you'll see it in every single chart. I put it in just to remind myself to consider it, and it's the four-way conjunction of Ixion, Quaoar, 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 Pholus, and Cupido. So if you go on the written one, it's right in that chart, right at the end of the PDF. this is a portal back in time. Capricorn is a time capsule. I'm working on a delineation of these things, which is, what is the truth of your ancestry? We all have a story, more or less bullshit story, about our ancestry, and usually that story only goes back to our great-grandparents. Most people don't know their great-great-grandparents and never talk to their great-grandparents about them. And when, how often have you talked to your parents about their grandparents, right? And many of our parents are not here anymore. This alignment of forces is talking about going back in time way further than your great-grandparents to understand something about the nature of who you are that is about the nature of the deep and distant past that influences in you, that you carry around in your body, in your cellular memory, in your personal history. And so I'm corresponding with a reader right now who told the story of, she's Italian, American. She told the story of going back to Italy and going back to Rome and finding out how happy the people were in Rome. This is her experience. They stop and talk to kids. They smile at each other on the street. They're not like Italian Americans. They're not like New Yorkers. It's a whole different scene. Much more open. Italian Americans, largely a bunch of pissed off people. They're productive, they work hard, they save money, they usually take care of their kids, but a lot of anger. Native Italians, in her experience, it blew her mind open that she was suddenly among Italian people who were friendly and loving. Huh, that's interesting. I went back to Sicily and I found out how mean people were. I went all the way back to the town where I traced the lineage of my godmother, my great aunt, Josephine Nicastro. And the mention of the name Nicastro made an old guy on the bus, old, he must have been like 105, riding the bus in this town where my grandmother came from. And he reacted with instantaneous visceral outrage at the mention of the name Nicastro. And my family left there around 1912, and I was there around 1996. Was that 85, 90 years? So what's contained in this story? What's contained in and lurking behind the story of our ancestry? How far back can you go to trace your origin? Some tribes say they come from the Pleiades. Some tribes say they come from Sirius. Some tribes come from the, whatever, galactic center. People have all kinds of mythology stories of the tribal origin. What's your evolving? Now, this is, you've got to break past your great-grandparents to find this out. The story of the origin of the tribe, the story of the origin of the human race. Very important. Look how close this is to who you are. This is the line of who you are. The first degree of Capricorn. It's right in the first decanate of Capricorn, trying to inform you or lead you on this quest to go to travel. Working the ancestry database could be helpful. Doing real genealogical work could be helpful. It's sometimes more or less possible. I would encourage any of you who say, oh, I'm just a mutt. I'm like Norwegian, German, Irish, French, Italian, Spanish, and Malaysian. Okay, what does that really mean? Like, where do you find yourself in that mashup? You're in there somewhere. And if you think, well, I'm just a mishmash, well, how does that work for you? You might want to reconsider that one. Okay, so that is most of what I have to say. I could go on. There's a lot more to say. There will be a spring reading. This is a lot of astrology for 1 year, but that's going to be, I'll keep reading it. I'll keep coming back to it. I'm probably going to sit in this very place and do the spring reading fairly soon. You might want to plan where you're going to be for the eclipse on April 8th. And, you know. finding yourself in your home, I think, is where everything comes back to. Okay. Thank you for your time, your trust, your business, your letters, and sticking with Planet Waves through these years as I have come in and out of being, you know, an incredibly unpopular person, but have persisted and happily maintained relationships with people I trust and who trust me. So thank you, especially more than anything, for that. And bye for now.